today's review for the final. The final questions are all taken from the quiz questions. The quiz questions are all taken from the homework questions. And the idea of the final is it's not to trick you or anything like that. It's what I consider to be the most important items, and that these are the things that I think you should leave the class with, that should go beyond the front door. After you finish your Geshe degree in the monastery, you normally forget everything after about 2 years, all the root texts. But you retain a certain amount always. And what I tried to do was figure out what I think people retain. And I think these are the things that are most important and that you should retain. So I'm going to go over some possible questions on the final. And the way I do it is just go around the room and let people take a shot. I know you're not prepared, and don't feel embarrassed. And just, well, it's more like a discussion than trying to embarrass anybody. Okay, we'll embarrass Pinto first. What's the main text that you use for studying the realms of existence?
Chögyam Bodzu.
Abhidhamma Kosha. By?
Lopan Yitnya.
Lopan Yitnya. Vasubandhu. 350 AD. And it's lucky, I don't think Abhidhamma is taught much in this country. There's a couple of books called Abhidhamma that don't have anything to do with Abhidhamma. That's another thing. Okay, number two. I don't know, Yulia, let's see. Try to divide the desire realm into 20 parts.
I'm not sure. I think this.
Remember 10 good and 10 bad. 10 and 10. 10 higher realms and 10 lower. That's how you get 10.
8 hells.
Yeah.
Crater realm.
Yeah.
Animal realm.
That's 10. 10 lower realms.
And there's the human realm.
Yeah.
So there's a ton of form. And the ton of form is run by forgotten numbers.
How many continents? Humans are the four continents, and then six god ones. So, 10 better ones. And then the demi gods, they just throw into the gods. So it's 10 and 10. So that's the more normal, when you're doing Buddhist geography, that's the 20. Up for the desire realm. Marji, why does the form realm have four levels and 17 different sections? This is just a general answer, okay? It's not, I mean, I could try to. My lama made me do all of them, 17, and you forget those in about a week. So, how do you get that many levels?
Three levels of three and four levels of eight.
Three levels of three and one level of eight. The fourth level has eight. But why are there 17? That's the main thing. Why does the form realm have 17 different sections and four different levels? What made it that way?
The different levels of meditation engaged.
Yeah, those are
causal.
Yeah, the form realm is a result, and then the causes for the form realm are the meditations in this life, and those meditations have four basic levels and 17 different details. So there's basically 17 different kinds of causal form realm meditation that you engage in this life, and then after you die, you're born into the form realm in one of those corresponding 17 sections.
So it's
four
something, four levels.
It's four somtens. The first three have three each, and the fourth one has eight. So that makes 17. The formless realm, I messed up in one of the classes. I don't know if it was yours or not. But just to make sure you know the names. You know the four realms, formless realms going up, right? What's the first one?
Formless realms?
Yeah, I'm talking formless now.
Okay.
And they were Namhatayin, Namchitayin. What was the third one? Chiaomet. And what was the fourth one?
Sincere.
Yeah, peak of existence. These are the resulting formless realms. Okay. Resulting formless realms. And the meditations that you do to get there, I think I messed it up on your notes, I'm not sure. So this is the result, these are the results, and these are the causes. For Namkataya, it's what?
Namkataya.
It's Namkataya, okay? It's the same thing, okay? It's the same. Okay. The name of the meditation is the same as the name of the realm you're going to be born into. Okay. about Nam Shi Tai?
Nam Shi Tai.
Same. Okay. I just think I messed up one for you. How about Jiang Mei?
Jiang Mei.
Jiang Mei. Now, who's going to make a fool of himself? Same thing. Now, this one changes.
So those are the names of meditations?
Yeah, these are the causal meditations in this life. Names of the four meditations. Basically, four mental states that you get into very, very, very subtle mental states. And if you stay in those a lot during this life, after you die, you go to those four levels of the formless realm.
How does that last meditation translate into English?
Yeah, that's a good question, okay? It's tricky. Dushi means what? Dushi means
consciousness.
People mistranslate it a lot. People say conceptions, and I don't know. It has that meaning in some cases, but as a mental function, it means the ability to discriminate. Dushi means the ability to discriminate. This is good, this is bad, this is high, this is low, this is hot, this is cold. Dushi Mei means what?
Nothing.
And what it means is there is no mind in the universe which can completely have no Dushi. In other words, any mind in the universe from an amoeba up to a Buddha has Dushi. All living creatures, including Buddhas, are making distinctions. But at this point, it's so, so low. It's at such a low capacity. In other words, the person's like on LSD or heroin or something, totally blissed out, almost incapable of saying this is left, this is right, this is up, this is down, this is good, this is bad. Just a totally, totally buzzed out state. And you could say they've almost reached, almost, you have to say, reached a state where they're no longer making any discriminations at all. But they're also du xian mei min, which means what? Yeah, they are almost mindless, and they're almost not mindless, okay? I mean, it's just a trick word to indicate how spaced out they are. And is it a good thing?
No.
No. I mean, the scriptures say, this is the peak of cyclic existence. This is the peak. Sitte means the peak of suffering. And many scriptures say, it's the same thing whether you're here in this incredibly buzzed out, you know, equanimous state, like some kind of a drugged out thing that lasts for millions of years. Or hung over a pot of molten steel in the lowest hell, upside down on a chain being dropped in. You know, they say the same thing. They say it doesn't really matter. They're both the same. Essentially the same thing. They're both the same kind of suffering. So it's not... And this is what a lot of Buddhist schools have been corrupted into, I think. I think a lot of Buddhist schools have been corrupted into teaching, you know, just get into a mindless state and stay there and everything will be nice and, you know, that'll somehow help you reach something. And it's a big mistake. And it's a mistake that Vasubandhu realized, you know, 2 millennia ago. So, it's not like the Tibetans made it up. This is the Buddha himself described these states, and Vasubandhu took it from the sutras. So you could call it the state of no discrimination and not no discrimination. It just means a very buzzed up state. As a causal meditation, leading in the next life to Sitte, which means the peak of cyclic existence. I think I reversed it when I first taught it the first day. I think I put this down here.
The cause for birth and form, that's meditation also?
Yeah.
Just different meditations?
It's the four somethings. It's called the four somethings. Samten Dhammo, Samten Nipa, Samten Sundar, Samten Shi. But they're just called number one, number two, number three, number four. They don't have separate names. The resulting ones have separate names.
And these are practices that went on back...
and you have to
in
learn...
In the days, and they would know, all right, I'm going to do this.
Well, these were taught in maybe non-Buddhist schools in those days. Did they intend to get that? I don't think they understood where they would go. Or maybe some of them thought that was nirvana or heaven or something. You know, it sounds like heaven. It's a lot like heaven. But it doesn't last. Mm-hmm. It wears out. But you do have to have the capacity, as we said many times, to get up to the first something in this life. You know, in order to see emptiness directly. You cannot see emptiness directly in a desire realm state of mind. It's impossible. Your mind, what we call shamatha, or ultimate level of meditation that's required to see emptiness, your mind actually has to be in another realm. Your concentration has to be above the desire, out of the desire realm. Your body is still here. And it's not very far. You don't even have to get into the main part of the first samdhan. You just have to get into the preliminary of the first samdhan. Yeah.
So this information then would have been transmitted to somebody by a Buddha in that person in a meditational state?
That this was going to happen or something?
Yeah, that this does happen given these causes.
There's these things called the five eyes. And if you meditate to a certain level, you can see these relationships. It's called five kinds of clairvoyance. And you can see them. Also, the Buddha describes them in the sutras. All right. Let's see. This is a tough question, okay? Sorry. basically, why are all these realms possible, according to the highest school of Buddhism? You know, why, for example, is hell possible? How did hell get there? Did somebody go down below the ground and with a construction company and build these chambers and all these... they have gas lines going down there and burning the places. And who made hell? And where did it come from? What makes hell? Ultimately, yeah. Ultimately, it's a projection forced on you by what? By your own past karma. Okay, so you can say in a sense that it's not outside of your own mind. Okay? In one very important sense, it's not outside of your own mind. Which means to get there is not difficult. Is it a psychological thing like having a bad day on earth? No. I mean, some teachers have tried to say that. It's not correct. I mean, it's not like just having a lousy day and everything looks bad. It's not a psychological coloring of your perceptions. It's a determination of your whole world by your projections. And there's a big difference. It's not just things look bad because you're having a bad day. It's that what you see is determined by your mind's karma. And you have no choice to experience anything else. And you do. It's only a projection, but it hurts. So that's how it can happen. And that's how you can go there.
You're saying there's no physical hell.
This is a big debate, but there is a... You will experience it as physical, but what makes you experience it is your own mind. It'll be as hard as that. Yeah. But does it exist outside of your own mind, independently? That's what inherent existence means. And it doesn't exist like that. It doesn't exist without your mind's participation. It cannot exist. If your mind wasn't projecting it, it wouldn't exist. Because your mind is projecting it, does it hurt any less? No. It hurts exactly the way it hurts because your mind is projecting it. So from the point of view of whether it hurts or not, or whether it's bad or not, it doesn't matter whether it's the way you always thought it was, or whether my information to you is correct. It's still going to hurt exactly the same. And you will not be able to get out any sooner or easier by understanding that. But you'll understand how to stop collecting the karma to make yourself see that. And that's why understanding that hell is not inherently existent is important. If hell depends on your own past deeds, then you can change. You don't have to go there. If it was just there on its own, this class would be meaningless. Because you couldn't get out of it. You're just wearing off bad karma. There is an incident in hell, like almost unprecedented, where the Buddha was a hell being. He was tied up to a wagon by a hell guard with like 15 other people, beings, and he was dragging this wagon through the hell, and he was being whipped and beaten from the back, and he looked to the side and he saw someone. He saw the person next to him suffering, and he had this moment's wish that he could take some of the suffering on himself. And then he disappeared from the hell, like that. There are some scriptures say that's his first moment of bodhicitta. other scriptures say it was the compassion that comes just before the nirvana.
Created by your own perfection. Can you experience it while being here, I guess?
No. I mean, you can, someone can take you there. And there have been, human beings have been taken to the hell realm to see what it's like. If you have some extraordinary karma, some extraordinary connection. In fact, the Wheel of Life was painted twice, and the second time it was painted, it was a result of one of the disciples of the Buddha who the Buddha took to hell. And then when he came back, he said, paint this and make sure everybody puts it at the door of their temple forever. And that's why we put it at the door of the temple. So you can observe it now, you can't experience it now, because there's no pain in this realm which is even close to a moment's pain in the hell. There's no pain in the human realm which would approximate 1 minute's pain in the hell realm. We can't experience it as a human. You can observe it, but you can't feel it. Okay. I guess I did anything cheery here. you got an easy one. How's the location of the formless realm determined? Where is the formless realm?
Exactly where everyone dies.
Yeah, it's wherever you die. Wherever you die, that your mind enters the formless realm, because there's no other boundaries. There's no form, so there's no play. Okay. Next, four ways of taking birth. I forgot to do. Come. Four ways of taking birth.
A womb.
Taking birth from a womb.
Warmth and moisture.
Warmth and moisture.
An egg.
Egg.
And
miraculous. Okay, cool. I don't know if you were in all the classes, but let's try this one. There's one general cause and three specific causes that can make you be born as a preta, as a crazy spirit. Do you remember them?
One
is the 10 minutes going to a pretty large
medium.
Yeah.
And
I got the answer,
so
I'm better off.
The other one is doing a lot of disrespect.
That was animal birth. Think of what they're like. Think of what, you see, you can kind of guess. Think of what they're like. People ask me, do you remember your past life? I said, no, but I know, I can guess. Since they're so driven by possessiveness or craving.
It was miser, miserly.
Yeah, like possessiveness. Jealousy. Jealousy and then failing to give the three kinds of giving, which are, Andy?
Three kinds of givings are giving material things, giving protection, giving help.
Yeah, cool. Okay. You guys must have learned something. tough thing. One general cause and two specific causes for birth as an animal. You got one already for free.
Ten bad deeds, committing 10 bad deeds. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, on a regular basis. Cool. Next is the six sufferings of a human realm, and human or ha realm. And I'll just ask you to give me one each. And to me, this is, you know, they go through this thing of, oh, you have to get old, you have to get sick. Since I'm not real old right now, and since I don't happen to be very ill right now, since I don't remember being born and death hasn't come yet, it's hard for me personally to relate to those things. They all seem to be four things that are not very close to me, personally. But these six I can see are suffering for everyone, and that they make the people in this room as unhappy as the people in Bosnia or Lebanon or wherever, Tibet. You know, I think if you think about these sufferings, you will come to see that there is as much suffering here in New York as there is anywhere. And that it's not an exaggeration, that we really do suffer from these six things, and that they are very painful, and that they ruin our life. So we'll go to them one by one. Aura, you have the first one? Or?
No certainty.
Yeah, no certainty in what sense?
In relationships, there's no certainty in friends, family,
yeah.
Especially after you die and change.
Yeah, so your interpersonal relationships, for example, are completely changeable. And in this life and in the following life. So if you don't even have to accept the following life. In this life, the person you've been closest to for a long time can become your worst enemy. We see it very, very often with divorces, for example, that the person whom you pledged a lifetime, to love and to honor until life do us part or something, that you actually hate them worse than anyone within a few years, you know, and it's not uncommon. And then the opposite happens. You have somebody that you, I mean, normally when you go to a company to work or something, or you join a class, it's like two or three people that immediately repel you. and then after a while you get to know them, and they turn out to be your best friend in the class, or something like that. Normally, like if you're jealous of somebody, then you don't like them for a while, but then they make friends with you, and then because they put you on their level, you say, oh, this is a great person, and you end up liking them. Okay. Jay,
second
one.
Everything changes.
What was that? Never met the Lom Mishepa. What's Lom
Mishepa? Never,
never satisfied. Never satisfied. And there was a lesson there, and you better write the whole lesson. What was the whole lesson? There's like three steps to this logic. I mean, it's not just never satisfied. That's too easy.
That when you have, you're no longer happy with it, or your attitude towards it changes, or doesn't last as it perishes.
It's more profound. He describes something much more nasty, much more ironic. What was it?
The defect of the human realm that we're capable of being satisfied.
That's one. But the trick, Tsongkhapa goes like this. He says, look, you desire an object. You want something. And then you go to get it. And then if you're unlucky, you get it. you acquire that object. And now something is supposed to happen at that point.
You want more.
But what's supposed to happen at that point? You're supposed to be happy. You're supposed to be contented. Contentment means you went after something, you acquired it, and it made you happy. And if this whole chasing of objects were real, then you would chase, catch up, grab it, acquire it, take it home, and then you'd just sit down and enjoy it. And that would stop your desire. That's how it's supposed to work. You're supposed to acquire it, and then that stops your desire for it, and then you get a thing called contentment. But then he says the irony is that the opposite happens. Each time you acquire something, then not only don't you get contented, it gives you more thirst. It makes you more thirsty. So you better write that on the final, okay? That's Tsongkhapa's noting that, I don't know what you call that, there's a word in English, but it's the, I don't know, it's just a horrible condition, it's a terrible thing. It's a great irony, a paradox, that you're supposed to, when you acquire something, it's supposed to give you contentment, and then you don't have to want it anymore, but instead you want something else worse. And that's the way we are, and we're always like that, with everything. What I mean is, it looks like one way, and it turns out to be a disaster. I don't know. Anyway, Maria, number three. Good. Oh, nice. And there was a trick behind that one. There was an irony behind that one. There was a story behind that one.
Yeah, you acquire bad karma by doing things that you think are good for your body, and in the end, you have to let it go, and you have accumulated bad karma, and that's the teachings for those of you.
Yeah. Perfect. Okay. That's a perfect answer. Okay. She said this. She said, you know, the point of serving your body at the expense of other people's bodies for some kind of unexplained prejudice that we have for our own bodies, you do all these things to protect and cherish your body and ignore the hungry and unclothed people around you. And then You're doing that to protect something which you have to lose anyway. But in order to do all that, you have to commit bad deeds, which are the only thing you do take with you. So it's this irony. You can't take with you what you've been fighting to protect, and the fighting gives you something that you must take with you. I don't know if there's a word for that. Anyway, disaster or something. Elizabeth, number four? We up to number four, I think. That's an easy one.
Yeah.
After
that one,
yeah. You have to... Yeah. And I don't have much story for that. I mean, I don't remember my stuff. You have to be reborn again and again. For a Westerner, you can't accept it right away. You have to study. And I don't think you can appreciate the repetitiveness of it until you've lived longer. Well, I think here we go again through this same classic kind of suffering. Mm-hmm. Something like that.
I don't know whether Jigsaw Kapa meant that at all, but if I just look at the little kids growing up, it's so hard just having teeth and learning to walk and clunk your head a million times. And it's not fun. It's very... I mean, like, I look at them and I go like, oh my God, I don't want to do that again.
I think that,
there's
and
no,
also
there's no goal in childhood.
It's the other five sufferings too. I mean, it's to go through the other five sufferings. Being born again means you get the other five automatically.
Yeah, we'd be lucky to do that again, right?
Yeah, yeah. Very rare. Very rare. That's true. Nancy Karen, number five. No? Guess any of them? I think it's one of the most striking ones. The last one is the most... Do you remember the last one? It's one of the most striking sufferings that a human has.
No.
Yeah, Tom Mepa.
No friends.
Yeah. Yeah. Number six is ultimately you have no companion. I mean, we come in alone. We have temporary liaisons with people. We meet up with people for a while and then we separate. We're ripped apart by karma. So we enjoy each other's company for a while, and then we have to leave each other, always. And then you're on your own again. And you die alone. By definition, you die alone. Somebody asked me, and I have to admit, that if you have a good root lama, and you have the proper relationship with your root lama, I don't think you'd be alone. But that's another story. Okay, That's a big exception. So if you have the proper relationship, I don't think you would ever be alone after that. Okay, Scott, what was number five, which we conveniently skipped?
Go from kind of high state of mind to a low state.
And Jetsu Kappa also glossed, he gave a short story to that. He said, this number five...
This is about
No, that was number one. Jetsun Kapa says very briefly, and I'll quote him directly. The point here is that any good thing that ever happens here in the circle of suffering life eventually turns into some kind of problem. We did this exercise last Friday night in class. I gave the class about 5 minutes to think of any good thing in their life. And then I called on five or six people to give me. And then we examined whether or not you have to lose it. And you have to lose all of them. There's no nice thing that ever happens to you in this life that you don't have to. You have to lose them all. And you have no choice. You will lose every good thing you have. From your friends, to all possessions that you own, to your own body, your name, your face, your identity. You'll lose everything. Every friend you have, you'll lose.
What about the Dharma?
You keep, well, this is, Shiwei Jesu Ludan Dimashin.
What about the Dhamma practice you did?
Shiwei Jesu Ludan Dimashin, Kana Lenden Chishi Dhamma. Nyepa Tembo Nyeni Nyepe, so Tashitawa Nangyan Bondan, Yesu Tashi Dhamma, Tatu Batan Dhamma, Chingin Lupa. That's, Jetsun Kapa says, the only thing that follows you is your bhakchas, your karmic bhakchas. And they are like your shadow, he says. They follow you like your shadow. You can't run away from those. So those you possess, yeah, those good karmas.
Yeah.
deep-seated good karma. You possess those. You have those. But they also will wear out.
But that's you that possess
it. Yeah.
Something that's going to be remembered.
It's a long story, but in the you're right in the sense that it doesn't really matter since you have to lose those also. You're just saying that you get to take them past death.
What's
staying
about becoming you? Because
you, it's a huge debate. Huge debate. Some people say you is only the continuation of your karma, but that would take about a year to discuss. Okay, but it's a good point. You have to lose everything. There's no good thing you can keep, period. So enjoy them while they last. There's no even small pleasure. We were discussing toast the other night. We decided you have to lose toast also. Somebody said your eyeballs. I said, no, and then you have to lose your eyeballs too. You can't keep anything. There's no nice thing you have that you're going to be able to, that's not going to turn lousy. There's no nice thing you have at all that's not going to turn into some kind of pain for you. Isn't there any good part in here? Tutum Pinzo, describe the example of seeds for crops of grain. Vasubandhu gives, he quotes sutras and he gives two explanations of why the bardo probably exists. And one is sort of a logical explanation and one is a scriptural explanation. What's the logical one? It has to do with those seeds. Explain the example of the grain.
The grain of seed is like the birth before. Yeah. And the sprouting is like the bardo.
Yeah.
And becoming a tree is like the next birth.
Right.
So for something to get to another state, it needs a conveyor or something.
There has to be an intermediate state. You can't go from seed to... You can't go from acorn to full-grown oak tree without something in between. It doesn't exist. You can't go to a fully completed being from the being at death without some kind of intermediate state. But he says specifically what? Chim Jambiang says, geographically speaking. So what's that mean?
Oh, it takes time.
Not just time, but something else going on. There has to be an intermediate state for another. You've got to get somewhere. Except for a formless realm being.
Uh-huh.
Except for a formless realm being who never has a bardo. There is no bardo for formless realm beings. Okay. Why?
They have that money.
They don't have to get anywhere. They don't need that time to get to where they're going. So Chim Jambiang is pointing out that the example of the grain is referring specifically to the time it takes to get to your new location. See, there has to be some kind of being who is also somewhat ineffable and also very fast and can get to the next life, can get to the location of the next life in between. So that's logical. You can't see it. It happens to be true. The belief that a bardo doesn't exist is as wrong as the belief that a future life doesn't exist, and there is not a shred of evidence for either one of those beliefs. There is none. We just grew up that way. There's no one shred, any kind of evidence that a future life doesn't exist. I mean, you can say to me that the responsibility is on you to prove it, and I can say to you, try to disprove it, because you can't, because it does happen to exist, and there is no evidence to the contrary. There isn't any. But you're just not used to thinking like that. Also, if you study Paramivartika, you can get more understanding of why there should be a future life. But the opposite idea that just because the body stops moving, the mind has stopped, is foolish. I mean, it's no proof at all. So when a guy gets knocked out, is he dead? When a person's sleeping nicely, are they dead? You know, it doesn't prove anything. Just because the body stopped, it doesn't prove that the mind stopped at all. It's a false assumption. But we've always assumed it. So, okay. The Buddha also... there's also scriptural proof for the existence of a bardo, because the Buddha, in one example, gives three conditions that must be present for a child to enter the womb. So what are they? Do you remember?
There has to be a woman who is
menstruating,
yeah.
Well, fertile woman, as we, a mother and a father, we can desire each other in sexual embrace. And the third one.
That's the one that proves the bardo, by the way.
All that has to be a bardo nearby.
Yeah, there has to be a smell eater nearby. And then Vasubandhu says a smell eater in this case refers to a bardo being. Because they eat smell. What about test tube babies? I think Vasubandhu would say in the majority of cases. No, that's how they often say that. That's often the caveat. You know, they say in the vast majority, 99.99%. Okay. Also, I think a better answer actually may be that they may see a mother and father having sex with them. They may see it anyway. Because there's a big argument that comes in this point in some of the Abhidhamma texts where they say, why would any bardo ever choose a hell realm? You know, if they saw a hell realm and people being beaten and tortured and burning, wouldn't they just turn around and run the other way? And the key to this is not so much that these three elements have to take place. The key here is the misconception. It's the total misperception that goes on. In this case, it's a bardo being seeing some wonderful, glorious thing going on and getting captured in the womb. But they say that the same thing happens with the hell. I mean, as they approach the hells look like these parks and everyone's having a good time. And it's the karma to have the final moments of a bardo are always in some kind of hallucination. And they accidentally go to someplace really bad. And they don't understand what's going on. It's a chinji lopa means they are under some gross hallucination, some gross misperception at that last moment. And they go there because it looks nice to them. And then they... Yeah, the karma forces them to think it looks nice. Mm-hmm.
And then to have that to the radical...
Yeah, which takes no more than a few sambas. And you know. Now you know why. Now you know how. This is just the nature of taking a rebirth, that you have that misperception at that last moment. At the last moment. Yeah.
You sound like the Bhagavan has choice, that sort of can sort of fly around.
Not really like that.
But they would not approach.
I mean, there's this classic thing of a Bhagavan running to a beautiful river, a Prerta, and it turns out to be a big stream of blood and pus when they get to the side. I mean, what I'm saying is that their sambas are shifting more often than ours. That's all.
What I mean is, like, couldn't it be that they perceive how horrible hell is, but they are still forced into it like a human
being?
Could be. Like, you sit someplace and a war breaks out and you see it, you're completely terrified, but you have no choice?
It could be like that, but that's the scripture tends to say the other. But you're also right. I mean, if they were going to have to be born there, they'd have to be born there. Okay. Have to perceive themselves being born there. I prefer to. Function of the four types of sustenance. What this means is very simple. And the reason the question is there is this. You know, it was a very interesting class about the kinds of sustenance. You know, food is a sustenance, sleep is a sustenance, hope is a sustenance, concentration. Keeping your mind on only a few things as you go through the day is a kind of sustenance. And the opposite is called stress, and it's an anti-sustenance, and it hurts your body. And those are all very interesting. But what this question is getting at this. Suppose you know all these things, and you keep your activities and your minds, you keep yourself, you make sure the phone's turned off most of the time. You eat organic food. You know, you walk to work and back. You do a marathon now and again. Suppose you do everything right, you know. I'm talking about doing everything right, and all your junwas, all those sachu melungs, are very, very well oiled, you know. What is the function of all those kinds of sustenance, ultimately?
To keep you here.
They perpetuate samsara. I mean, they are, and that's the answer to the question, they are perpetuating. The Buddha says, this is a direct quotation from the Buddha, The four types of sustenance are the very root of sickness, cancer, agony. They help bring about old age and death. I mean, they're just contributing to your death. I mean, does it mean that you should abuse your body? No. Your vows, your bodhisattva vows, and your lamrim instructions require you to take care of your body. Which kind of vow? Anyway, it's one of your vows.
Would you repeat the quote again?
He says, the four types of sustenance are the very root of sickness, cancer, and agony. They help bring about old age and death. Basically, they perpetuate korva. But the point I'm trying to make is that you must do all those right things for your body, but don't get hung up on it. I mean, we saw one of the facts of the meditation on death. Number three of the certainty was what? Reason number three for the certainty of death. That was for something else. That was for when you're going to die. That's number six. Yeah, I mean, even if you want to, even if you decide to, even if you have all the money in the world, you know, even if you've got this great Dharma teacher and you go home and say, okay, I really believe it, now I'm only going to practice Dharma. You don't have any time anyway. You know, there's no time. I mean, we get so frustrated. You know, if you've tried to do your Dharma practices, it's so frustrating. So what I'm trying to say is don't give it an excessive amount of time. You know, feeding yourself. A, overfeeding yourself. B, getting too obsessed with how you look or you know, are you quite up to the muscle tone? I translated for Yeshe Dundan on WBAI one day, and the guy was talking, and the guy was saying, and his muscle tone is not too good, actually, you know. He really, Khaste Mendandala, Rigpa Yi, Nagarjuna said, eat food as if it was medicine, you know, and he just eats exactly what's needed to keep him going. When the doctor says do this or does that, he does exactly that, and he's totally disciplined. You know, he doesn't eat anything he doesn't have to eat, and he eats exactly what he should eat, but he doesn't get hung up about his body. You know, he just does exactly what he's supposed to do to take care of it in a very disinterested way. It's kind of cool. Okay, eight hot health. We'll just go through. Give me like, how about two? The classic way of counting is to go to number eight and then go to number one. That's classic way of listing them, okay? Just for your interest, information. Name is number eight, okay? Which is what? Avicii health. Basically, at that point, your whole physical form is indistinguishable from the fire. It looks like an incandescent filament. You are burning like an incandescent filament. And the only way they can tell that you are alive is that there's some kind of whimpering coming out of that flame. And that's the only recognizable sentient thing about it. Like that. And then the first hell? Yangtze. Yangtze, which means what?
Revive.
And I think you can all appreciate, if you've been in an office setting, this thing about, you know, you appear there and everyone's beating each other, you know, with whatever they can grab, you know. I mean, immediately, the minute you're there, all your instincts tell you, grab something and fight. You know, grab whatever's in reach and pick it up and hit the next person. And there, because they're hitting you, and the minute you appear there, it's this melee, you know, and it's deadly. It's a deadly fight from the minute you're there to the minute you end. And it's just, you're clawing at people or pulling people's eyes and pulling up anything you can grab and smashing it on the other people. Anything you can get to use for a weapon, you're using it. And they live like that. They just sit there. That's their existence. It could be like that. Plessy, give me two more. What's Thich Nhat? That's one. Dijon. Which? Where do they gather you? Between two great mountains. And then they come together and smash you. And they look like what? Do you remember? Yeah, they look like the heads of animals that you've killed. if you're a big meat eater, by the way, that's a different story. But, and then Thich Nhat, Black Line. You remember that one? Leon?
Yeah. Enjoy the pain, and you just reassemble yourself and get hurt some more.
Yeah, the trick is that after you're cut up, the parts still feel like they're together. They still, the finger's hurting, the toe's hurting, the arm is hurting, the leg is hurting. Okay. Next to hell, Judy Hill. By the way, I say that you have to take care of yourself. I mean, each to his own needs. I don't mean to say that you shouldn't run marathons. I think it's probably wise, actually. But I think each person knows themselves what's necessary for them. And you, the Lam Rim is adamant that you must take care of yourself. And many great lamas have told me that I should exercise as well. Seriously, have. And told me that I should eat the way Serge tells me I should eat. I don't want to listen to him. Lumba and Lumba Chamba. Thomas? Screaming and great screaming. I'm still never sure. There's a translation problem there, or whether it's the second chamber is a double chamber, or whether it's two little houses. Or it's not clear to me. I've read a couple of commentaries. It's still not clear to me. The word in the first Dalai Lama's commentary, I've never met anyone who could explain it to me. Basically, you are inside of a... It's like being inside of a safe. And they... Am I wrong? Sorry. Oh, sorry. These are just more like frying pans. Okay, yeah. I mean, an endless, miles long, and you can't ever get to the end. It's just running. And then Sawa and Raptasawa. Heat and superheat. What's the name again?
Joshua,
yeah, I'm sorry. Four kinds of eons, Kalpa. By the way, there's six kinds, and I messed it up, so you're pretty much free on this question.
Okay, you have Bar Kao, which is intermediate.
Yeah.
You have something in the name of the light to take for Buddha.
Yeah, Kalten, big Kalpa. Great Kalpa.
And then
And then the one I left out, which was the empty kalpa.
Yeah.
Kalpa of emptiness. So I guess if you were really going to answer this question, well, it's up to Thupten how to grade it, but I'd say it's probably destruction, continuation, formation, and then empty, making a great kalpa. And that makes a lot more sense. So the key is long there. I would make it last. So it would be destruction, formation, continuation, and empty. And then another formation.
No, destruction, empty.
I'm sorry.
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, it would come out of that. Destruction,
say again, please.
Empty, formation, and continuation. Destruction, empty, formation, and continuation. And the first Dalai Lama never explains the empty ones. I guess there's nothing to explain. All right.
And then three?
And all four of those together makes one great, because one great has how many parkal? 80.
And then, so you'd say barkal first? You want us to put in great and barkal?
You can leave out barkal. All right. Describe the events that open and close the eon of destruction. What marks the opening of it, and what marks the ending of it?
The opening is when no more helpings take birth in all knows, right? And the closing of it is when the planet is destroyed.
Cool. When the world goes up in smoke. What do you call it?
When the seventh sun is
destroyed. There's a cool word for that.
Vaporizes.
Yeah. Poofs. Tessie. What is the length of time that a person must accumulate the collections of merit and wisdom to become a Buddha? How long do you have to work to get those?
One great eon, which is 8 barkals, times countless, which is 10,
Yeah, exactly. Dharma math matters. I don't think I mentioned Chang Mei, the word countless. Yeah,
yes.
Chang Mei Sum. It always says Chang Mei Sum. Very famous. Chang Mei Sum means three countlesses. What is it? Chang Mei Sum Ji Jiao Wei. Chang Mei Sum La San Ge. It goes like that. That's half of it. That wouldn't get me through the day. Tame Nama Sumla Sangye, something like that. It goes across two verses, actually. Tame Sumla Sangye means it takes three countless eons for a Sangye, for a Buddha.
So, how did you want the answer?
How's it go? So that's another part. That's a different part. Yeah, that. See? That's it, the last one. The last line is it. Yeah, that's just describing that they occur during those loops. Anyway, it says Chang Mei Sum La San Ge.
Chang Mei means countless?
Yeah, the word Chang Mei means countless, but it refers to a specific number.
So only one is
called Chang Mei.
Chang Mei Sum La San Ge is only one
of them? Oh, I'm sorry, I have it here. Dei Chang Mei Sum La San Ge. Dei Chang Mei Sum La San Ge. That's the verse. Dei Chang Mei Sum La San Ge. Yeah, that's what you started with.
Do you want the whole verse or just that line?
Just that line. Okay.
Thank you.
We got the death meditation. Is it your turn, Lauren? Okay. The four broad steps in the whole outline of death meditation. Yeah, good. So, the problems of thinking you're not going to die tonight, the advantages of... Have you tried it? It's cool. Did you try it? Mm-hmm. Rinpoche always asks this and everybody sits tonight. Because they don't want to lie to Rinpoche. Did you try it? I mean, it changes, right? It changes your life a little bit. The more you do it, the better. It's kind of cool. Disadvantages of not thinking you're going to die tonight. Advantages of knowing you're going to die tonight. Acting like that. And then identifying death meditation. I mean, you know what it's not, which is what? Or, it's not trying to train yourself in panic because and that's natural. You don't have to train yourself. And then, so what is it?
It's knowing that you could not be looked after and seeing it
together. Yeah, that will help you, especially after you die. But then when the time comes, you're already, everything's taken care of. Especially if you've used that as a stepping stone to higher practices, to the higher practices. And you've achieved what you needed to. So then you can die happily. There's no problem. You can die smooth. You got what you had to do. Okay. So Josh, we picked on you already. Jay Siller, there were three reasons behind the second principle in death meditation. The second principle is what Nam Chi Mang Epa, which means what? Never sure when you're going to die. Can't be sure when you're going to die. Then there were three meditations inside of that. What were they? Remember?
The time of death is uncertain.
In this realm.
Yes.
In this particular realm. Lifespans are not fixed.
Lifespans is what are fixed.
In our realm. I mean, nobody on this planet can tell you when they're going to die. Period. Maybe people on other planets. Not on this planet. Normally. Unless they're planning it themselves, I don't know.
Our clock, our bodies are fragile.
That was number three. Number two?
That most things are not good. Most things are bad for us, and few things help keeping us alive.
Yeah, there's lots of things that can kill you, and there's only a few things that can keep you alive, and they're hard to get anyway. Yeah. If you don't believe me, go to work. All right. Maria, three resolutions that you should make. And they relate, by the way, they relate to the three principles. So if you don't remember the three decisions, you try to remember the three principles and they give you a clue.
So since death is inevitable,
since you don't know when you're going to die, you can stop practicing now. And since only Dharma can help, practice only now. Great. Wonderful. Lexo. That's about it. I said it before, I'll say it again. If you go home, and you, I don't know how much death meditation you did between last class and this class. Personally, I remembered it 3 or 4 times. Okay? And it's not good enough. It's not enough to make it do anything. I really encourage you to keep it up as a practice for the next couple of months. Try to do it formally in the morning. You know, I have found personally that if I meditate on something formally in the morning, I do think about it throughout the day. It comes up maybe once every couple hours or something, that I'll actually start to do something bad, and because I meditate in the morning about it, I remember, and if I don't meditate in the morning, then I don't remember, and I go ahead and do it. So try to do some meditation in the morning and about death, and then it'll start to appear during your day, you know, at interesting times. And then, you know, like this afternoon, I was thinking, is this really what I want to do? I went to a movie last night, and I was debating, you know, I was like, let's see, if I'm going to die after the movie, is this really what I want to do? Some friends invited me to a movie, so I'm like, I don't want to make them upset, but what I want to do if I'm going to die tonight? And you have to think about it. You have to make that. It could be the right decision to go, but you have to examine it. You know? Yeah. Yeah, it'll come. Renunciation doesn't take it. I always say it doesn't take an Einstein. You know, it's just being fed up with the way things are, and I think most of us are. It's just admitting it. You know, it doesn't take a genius to say, everything nice about your life is going to die. You know, the people that you love, you're going to lose. The health you have, you're going to lose. You'll stop being able to read. I mean, I love reading, and I love reading Dharma, and I know that my eyes are going, and that there'll be a time when I can't read it anymore. I see Rinpoche, he can't read things anymore, and he can't hear anymore, and it'll come. All the things that are dear to you, you will lose. So it doesn't take a genius to get renunciation. I mean, you have to do something about it. And we have, those higher practices which are effective in this lifetime to stop those things. So you have to learn them, and then you have to really, and they're cool and they're fun, you know, and they're very much a pleasure to do in a deep way. So there's no reason not to do them. That's all. Rinpoche has not announced the date for the preliminary initiation, but he did agree to it. So we'll be, you know, twisting his arm. And we're probably going to do a 3-day meditation here in May sometime, probably very late, probably the third week of May or something. And we'll try to organize that. And Friday night class will go on through the end of April and then stop. Tutan Prinzel doesn't know, but he's going to teach it in May. Okay? Friday night. If you're here. We'll talk about it. That's embarrassing. But. And then we're kind of talking about taking a total break, like June 15th to July 15th. You know, just totally off. So you can take a rest. And then after that, we'll start a class I'll start a course around July 15th on Vinaya. I can't teach you the monk's vows or the nun's vows. I'm not allowed to, but there is a text, by Tsongkhapa, which has never been studied, I don't think, in this country. And there's a commentary which I'm sure has never been studied in this country. Beautiful commentary. And we'll be going over that commentary, the parts that I can teach you, because it, just to know what the vows are, how you get them, how you lose them, which ones can a person take, which ones should you take, which ones you have to be ordained to take, which ones don't even exist anymore, things like that. All the details. There's a lot of Dharma, there's a thing I call Dharma rumors, Dharma misinformation. Now, everybody has this idea about what's Vinaya, and mostly it's wrong. So I think it'd be nice, if you're going to be educated baby geshe, then you should know at least some good, clean, pure information about Vinaya. And Tsongkhapa wrote a fantastic short piece, which we'll study the whole thing. And we have a beautiful commentary by one of the lineage holders of our secret tradition. So we'll be studying that. If that group translates it on time. That's about it. I can't think of anything else. Rinpoche will not teach this Sunday because he'll be in Washington. He will not teach the following Sunday because of... Oh, he's having a special teaching. And then I believe after that he'll start on Sundays. And then he continues to teach on Thursday nights. I don't believe... He's not teaching this Thursday night because he doesn't want to tire himself out for Washington. Oh, and this Thursday is Sojo anyway. Okay. Oh, your exam is a week from Saturday at 10 o'clock.